This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
You have fallen into Event Horizon with John Michael Godier. In today's episode, John is joined by Dr. Ravi Kopparapu. Dr. Ravi Kopparapu is a planetary scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. His research interests are in extrasolar planet habitability, atmosphere modeling and characterization, as well as identifying technosignatures and biosignatures. He is the co-chair of the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics UAP study. Remember to subscribe to Event Horizon so you never miss an episode.
Dr. Ravi Kopparapu, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, Doctor, one of your specializations is in liquid water in the universe, the solvent of life, the very beginning of it all. With exoplanets, there seems to be no reason to suspect that Earth is in any way unique with its liquid water oceans. What are the prospects right now of liquid water being found on exoplanets? Can we actually do that? Can we infer at this point and say that liquid water is common in the universe on planetary surfaces?
Yes, I think it's quite plausible for us to detect liquid water on exoplanets. And the reason for that is because one of the few things that we have found, and most important, profound things that we have found in the last few years is that there are more planets outside our solar system than within our solar system. So far, we know more than 5,000 exoplanets, planets orbiting other stars. And water seems to be one of the most common compound that could form on several of these planets, just based on chemistry and physics. Oxygen is one of the most abundant elements, and hydrogen is, of course, the most abundant element in the universe, right? So water seems to be a more favorable compound to form. And with upcoming telescopes, there is a way, definitely a way, for us to detect liquid water and on the surface of these planets.
Now, what's the profile look like? Now, you need temperature for liquid water within the habitable zones of suitable stars. But what about pressure, atmospheric pressure, and things like that? What other peripherals are there that define whether liquid water can exist on a planetary surface?
That is an excellent question, actually. So temperature is not the only parameter that you would want to have, as you just mentioned. Pressure is also important. For example, if you take a cup of water and keep it on Mars right now, it might boil away even though temperature is pretty cold over there, just because atmospheric pressure is not enough for water to stay in a liquid form. So different kinds of exoplanets have different kinds of pressure and temperature regimes that could make water, liquid water, to be within the parameter region where it is possible to stay in the liquid form. We have liquid water under the subsurface of some of the moons, Jovian moons, in our solar system. Liquid water could also exist on different chemical conditions. So, for example, we don't need to have nitrogen and oxygen atmosphere to have liquid water. We could have hydrogen, for example. Under sufficient pressures, you could create liquid water on the surface of a planet if it has only hydrogen and some other carbon dioxide or something like that.
So we have a very good example of a planet with liquid water oceans. We also have oceans we strongly suspect locked underneath the shells of ice and moons like Enceladus and Europa. But we also have weird ones. We also have Titan with liquid hydrocarbons. So can it be possible, do you think, chemically speaking, for alternate solvents, for example, ammonia or liquid hydrocarbons, could life of some sort presumably microbial, arise in those liquids?
It is certainly possible. We need to know the chemistry. So we need to, if we are trying to postulate for a different kinds of life, we need to come up with a life cycle and a metabolism activity that that life, particular life, could take and undergo through its life cycle. So we focus mostly on water and water-based life because water is a solvent, a polar molecule, right? It can form chemical bonds easily with other molecules. And so for the kind of life that we see on Earth, it's easy to form these chemical bonds and multiply and form, you know, complex organisms. And that's one of the reasons why we mostly focus on liquid water or water-based life. If we are proposing for a life that is looks different, as you just mentioned, with some other chemical compounds, we also need to come up with the biochemistry that can support that kind of life. It's not just enough for us to say, okay, there could be life based on these chemical compounds, but if this life is using these chemical compounds, here is how it can go through a life cycle, its biochemistry. And so if we can come up with a complete theory of that, then yes, it is possible to have a different kind of life, not based on water solvent.
Now, we come up to an interesting situation with the question of microbial life in the universe, simple life. And that is, we look far and near. We look at Mars, we look at anything that looks like it could host microbial life, a second abiogenesis in the solar system. And we have no problem with that, you know. Look for it, send probes. But also, we have the idea of looking for biosignatures and exoplanets, some evidence of life far away. This stands in stark contrast to how we view technosignatures, and we'll get to that in a bit, and the UAP phenomenon, where there is a hesitancy to look close, as opposed to looking distantly for radio signals in SETI. But back to microbial life in the solar system. If it happened here, which we stand as an example, and we have some indicators maybe that there might be microbial life in the atmosphere of Venus or on subsurface Mars. But looking out, what do you think the best biosignature gases that we could detect would be for an exoplanet that would lead us to conclude that there's probably a biosphere present on there?
So this is a really great question, because this is literally what we have been doing right now and will keep doing if we want to discover life on exoplanets. For example, if we want to find, there is not a single biosignature gas or a combination of gases. The reason for that is, if you look at Earth's history, we have several different biosignature molecules that could indicate that there was life on Earth. And the reason why I'm pointing to life, Earth's history, is because that is the only planet we have, a template we have for life that we know of. And so if we look for life 2 billion years ago, at that time there was no oxygen. It was only carbon dioxide and methane dominated atmosphere, along with nitrogen, of course. Nitrogen was always present throughout our Earth's history. And that, if you look at an exoplanet, like Earth, that was 2.7 billion years ago with modern telescopes, you would find carbon dioxide and methane, and that's a biosignature. And there is also, if you look at the present Earth's atmosphere, you would find oxygen, methane, water vapors, carbon dioxide, and so on. Those are also a combination of biosignature gases. So when we detect these kind of gases on an exoplanet, all we can say is that this is a good indication of a planet with life on it. But we cannot confirm that that is indeed coming from life, because there is always a possibility that there is a biological mechanism or abiotic mechanism that can produce all this combination of gases together. And the way we want to look at it is, it's not just enough to detect these gases. We also want to know at what levels these gases are being emitted from the surface of a planet, so that it is consistent with biology. And so if you ask me what are the biosignature gases, I would say for the present Earth, it would be oxygen methane combination and ozone combination, because they should not be existing together. But that's just not enough. We need to also find at what levels they are being emitted. And if you were asking for Earth past history, you would look for carbon dioxide, methane, and so on, for our biosignature gases.
So there is no one single instance where we could say that's life. Rather, we need a profile and we need to look for disequilibriums and things like that. But it is in principle possible to conclude, come to a conclusion based on the observations of an exoplanet atmosphere that there is a biosphere there. So the profile would give us a reasonable way to conclude that's the case then, right?
Right. The context is important. Even if we discover these gases, we need to understand the environmental context this planet exists around the star. We need to know more about the star. We need to know about the planet size, mass, and what star's environment, radiation environment, this planet exists. And then if we find these gases, these are all circumstantial evidence to build up our case for and build confidence in our detection that, oh, yes, this planet looks like very likely a habitable planet, an inhabited planet, not just habitable. There's a difference.
Or as it were, was inhabited.
Yes, yes.
Now, what of planetary size? So we talk about things like mini Neptunes and super Earths and things like that, which I know that you study. Is there an upper limit for a terrestrial planet to support life? In other words, can an exoplanet be too large for life?
There comes a point where there would be, when as the planet size grows, it becomes extremely high pressure environment. And from our understanding of how life behaves, extreme pressures and extreme conditions may not be conducive to the kind of life that we want, we are looking for. Of course, people then will point to, how about hydrothermal vents? You know, there are toxic environments and hot situations, right? Well, how do we know about hydrothermal environments? Because we actually went there and we started looking. We physically went there. We were able to go there. We had that luxury. But for exoplanets, we don't have that luxury to go there and then dig someplace and then find extreme environment situations. So we have to look only for those kind of environments where we think life could exist. And then someone can say, okay, then you might be missing many possible locations for life. That's true. We will never be able to find all possible regions and conditions where life could exist. And the first kind of life we might be able to detect are those conditions where it's more easier for life to sustain than in the extreme conditions.
Now, back to a point on water. So we have an indicator with our own star system of liquid water off Earth. For example, it seems very compelling at this point that Mars was once a very wet world. And possibly even Venus, it's been suggested that it had its period of oceans as well. So here we have terrestrial planets that have water or had water on them. Then we have the maddening part. Many, many suspected ice shell moons. And unfortunately, the ice shell moons of the universe are probably outside of our reach as far as being able to observe and learn much about other than maybe if exomoons exist or not. But this star system really has a lot of water, suggesting that planetary bodies with water, both in the form of terrestrial planets and ice shell moons, it just must be so common out there that it's unbelievable. Wouldn't you concur on that?
There definitely that water is quite common, either on the surface or under the surface of the planets. Yes, that seems to be the case within our solar system at least.
Do you think it can go the opposite direction and have too much water on an exoplanet? In other words, it could have an oceanic biosphere, but no land, therefore probably no technological civilizations or prospects for it. Do you think that could be a great filter, an answer to the great silence, is that most exoplanets have too much water?
So I wouldn't go that far, just because that we don't know under what conditions life could develop and under what conditions technology could develop either. Okay, there might be things that are available to them that we may not have, and they might be even more conducive to life to exist. So I wouldn't dismiss away right away if there is an ocean planet with lots of water. That would be a good habitable location. And the only way to find out if it is inhabited is to actually see if there are any atmospheric signatures through remote observations.
Now, looking for a little bit more than microbial life, let's move up to the level of plants. What is your view on the possibility of looking for things like the vegetative red edge? Do you think that we could ever establish reasonably that there's more than just microbes on an exoplanet?
I would really hope so. I think it's certainly possible because each star has its own radiation environment. And so some environments are more favorable for plant kind of life, advanced life. There was even a paper by my colleague Nancy Kiang at some, think about 10-15 years ago, where she discussed about what kind of colors plants could have on around different kinds of planets, around different kinds of stars. So for example, around cool stars, plants may look black because cool stars don't emit as much light as our sun does. And so plants have to absorb any radiation, any light that comes from the host star. And so they have to be black because black absorbs most of the radiation anyway. And so plants might be, you know, black in those on those planets.
Lisa, really, the imagination runs wild imagining a sort of grayscale world of white volcanic rock interspersed with black planets.
Right.
Very, very unearthly. Now, technosignatures, moving back up further. We look for technosignatures via radio signals mostly, ever since Kokoni and Morrison's paper and Frank Drake. And we haven't seen anything yet. What is your response to that? I mean, do you think that we just haven't looked enough to say that we really know anything? Or do you think we've looked enough to say that maybe intelligent life in the universe is rare?
I'm so glad you asked this question. So, because I have some opinions about this. First of all, radio's search for technosignatures is one aspect of the whole field of technosignatures, right? And it was the first one that has started, that was started a few decades ago. And it's still going on. It's a very strong search. It's also unambiguous detection of technology. We don't know of any natural process where we could have a radio emission from coming from a natural process other than a technological civilization. So that's one thing that that's been going on. There are other ways to look for other things. We can look for technosignatures. We can think about that. We can talk about it later. The fact that we haven't found them yet, I think it's more related to a time question and also what we are searching for. I'll give you an example. If you go to New York and then stand near a bus stand and stay there for 2 seconds and come back and tell me that, hey, okay, I stood there for 2 seconds and then there was no bus, so New York doesn't have any buses at all. Okay, that's because you haven't waited long enough. And that's probably one of the things that I think is why we weren't able to find any radio communication signals or radio contact with civilizations. But that also assumes we can recognize a bus, which means we are assuming that we are so intelligent that we will be able to recognize any kind of radio emission coming from space. That's also one assumption, right? There are other ways for us to even look for technosignatures. We don't have to wait for the technologically advanced civilizations to send signal to us. Imagine this. Right now, we are building telescopes to look for atmospheric technosignatures, pollution on the planets, or city lights on planets. And this is actually a research work going on. We published papers on this. And we are trying to see how future telescopes can look for these city lights, look for pollution. If we can think about those kind of things, I'm sure any advanced civilization has already done that. And so they don't have to wait for our radio communications to reach them. They'll just build a telescope and look at us. And same thing we can do too. And so the reason why your question about why we haven't found any is, one, probably because we haven't looked long enough. Two, we are just about to start looking for other kinds of technosignatures, so we need some more time for that. And three, it assumes that we can recognize a technosignature when we see one.
Now, I love that sentiment that maybe you have to wait longer than 5 minutes for the bus. In regards to profiles, again, maybe that's the approach we need, is a multi-pronged search for more technosignatures than just radio and do it for a longer duration. Do you think that it's likely that had we gotten a signal, we may very well have missed it before now? And what would an ideal search for technosignatures as a profile be in your view?
I think it should be for if you want to detect a technosignature, we should be looking at all wavelengths, at all the whole spectrum of technosignatures. We should look for anomalies, not just the ideas we have. Yes, of course, you know, some of the things I mentioned about pollution, city lights, radio signals, even laser pulse emissions, we were looking. These are all the things that we can think of that a potential civilization could do, because that's what we are thinking that we could do, right? But then there could be also things that we do not know, the unknown unknowns. Those are called anomalies. And so when I talk with my colleagues, I say that we should not only look for the things we know, we should also look for things that don't fit into the data, that look different, that they look anomalous in the data, and try to investigate those things. That is the only way we will find new science. That's the only way we can probably find fundamental discoveries.
I think the delightful thing here is that we are starting to see such anomalies. Examples would be KICA 462852 or Shabilsky star, just objects that just hint that there's something there, but maybe there's also, of course, you have to exhaust all of the natural explanations first to get there, and we haven't been able to do that. But we are starting to see anomalies, and I think that with the instrumentation that's coming online, especially with things like the Vera Rubin Observatory coming, I think we're going to see a lot of those. Do you anticipate that we are entering a great age of anomalies where we're going to be talking about aliens a lot more than we used to?
I think we are already there, because any new great observatory, when it goes up, you know, when it opens its eye, we always find new phenomena. It happened with Hubble, it happened with Spitzer, it happened with every telescope that's out there, you know, whenever there was X-ray emissions or radio telescopes. So I'm sure it's going to happen with any new technology or any new telescope when it opens up.
Now, one such anomaly that we saw happened way back in 1977, the WOW signal. And the vexing thing about the WOW signal is that it looked technological, and it looked like what you would expect. It was at the hydrogen line for an alien signal, or at least as we thought of it then, that might be a convenient place to broadcast if you want to get the attention of others. Yet, we only ever saw it once. It hasn't repeated since, and recently it was even looked at in a very targeted way towards a sun-like star that had been identified as maybe the source of it, or had been suggested anyway. So they did a targeted search. So once again, we look for the WOW signal and we see nothing. Do you think the concept of a self-contained, self-confirming radio signal in SETI is possible? In other words, can you make a single one-off radio signal, radio transmission, look so weird and so unambiguous that you couldn't mistake it for anything else, even if you only saw it once, meaning it's a transient, you only see it once? Could we possibly confirm that with a weird enough signal?
I would be hesitant with just one-off signal, because nature is clever. Okay, nature has many, many ways of making things happen. And just because we have eliminated all our own understanding of natural phenomena doesn't mean that nature doesn't produce that. And so if we have a one-off phenomena and if we are quite confident on it, I would not rush and claim that this is certainly coming from a non-natural sources. I would phrase it in a way that, okay, we looked at it and we have eliminated all natural generation phenomena for this kind of event that we have detected. And that's where I would stop. I would not go further than that, saying that it could be coming from where, whatever. I would say we have eliminated all the natural sources that we could think about, and that's about that.
But that's something. That's something. It's a step in the right direction.
Yes.
Now, say we did get a repeating signal, something that we can really take a good look at and determine that it is of alien origin. Well, there's that question answered, but naturally people are going to ask, well, what's the signal say? And to this, I usually respond, well, I don't know, it may be like radar and there may be nothing there, you know, no information content. Do you think if we got a complex alien signal that repeated, that we could nail down to an alien civilization, do you think we could ever decode the transmission, or is that forever out of our reach?
I think it's probably possible that we may never be able to decode it. But I think given enough time and enough minds, we are a clever species. We are here with an advanced technology. We might at least make headway into answering at least a part of that puzzle that they've from that signal. We may not be entirely able to solve it. But then if it's a repeating phenomena, we are good at repeating, looking at patterns. So I think there's a good chance we may be able to decode it.
Now, speaking of patterns, we'll get into that in a bit regarding the UAP phenomena, because I have some questions about patterns and that stuff. But before we get there, if we get a signal from a distance, we see an alien civilization and we look at it and say it's 10 light years away. Does that tell us something about the distribution of civilizations in the galaxy? Meaning that if there's one that close, then there are probably a whole lot of them out there, right?
Absolutely. I think I'll be stunned if we find something nearby and we have missed it all these years. But that also assumes, like I said before, we would be able to detect something and we know all sorts of signals that the civilization might be emitting, and we are able to recognize those kind of signals. And so I would be quite happy and also quite surprised if we find anything nearby, an advanced civilization nearby.
Now, do you think the question of are we alone can be answered within a reasonable amount of time, our lifetimes, for example, that maybe the abiogenesis researchers will find that abiogenesis was easier than we thought, or something like that, therefore life must be ubiquitous in the universe, or we see another exoplanet, habitable, you know, within the habitable zone of a star, we see an exoplanet that's showing biosignatures. Does that tell us, does the very first confirmation of extraterrestrial life, not of an origin on Earth, does that tell us immediately that the universe teems with life and that it is everywhere, no matter how far distant the detection is?
I think that's a good sign, because I believe that at least I, from my perspective, that is a really good indicator that we would be able to find more sites for this biogenesis on other planets, if we discover one of them. And that's a good sign.
What do you think about the funding? Do you think the detection of a candidate biosphere on an exoplanet will cause researchers and funding to just dramatically increase, thus increasing our chances of finding a third example?
So more than funding, I would say the amount of interest from everyone, even from my mom, for example, or from anyone I relative, would be tremendous. I mean, imagine, this is one of the most fundamental discoveries in humans, in our, you know, history of humans. Who wouldn't be interested in this? Like, you found life on a world that is not on Earth, that's from another planet. And so there would be tremendous interest in this. And I would think that eventually that interest will go promote more and more investigations and more interest from, hopefully, from our leaders.
Do you think the detection of alien life in whatever form would serve to unite the species? In other words, we suddenly become the humans from Earth as opposed to nation states and things like that. Do you think that the discovery of alien life would have a positive effect on human civilization?
I think it will certainly give a perspective on us that, okay, look, we are all from Earth. We are all in this together. We found, when we say we, the humans on Earth found life on other world. So we can, and that means that we are able to have that kind of technology. If we can come together, we can make even more fundamental discoveries. And so I think that would be a great and profound discovery if from all perspectives, even for general public, to have that when we find life on other planets.
I think the best case scenario, what would really, I could die very happy, as if we saw some mega engineering project like a Niven ring or something like that out there that aliens have constructed, because it means that you don't automatically go extinct and you can produce amazing planetary scale technologies. And to me, that would suggest, you know, maybe we can really have a positive future and build something like that someday. Do you have a similar sort of feeling regarding that?
Yes, when we see another advanced technology, a civilization, or when we discover one, that gives confidence, that gives some sort of comfort for us that, okay, we can survive our own immaturity or our evolution into a new technological civilization. And that's, that confidence is really, really important, because we will have that kind of a surety that we can be part of several technological civilizations out there, and we can survive our own misfortunes.
Now, say we find it. We get a radio signal, and it turns out to be somebody radaring asteroids in their star system or something like that. They have their own Arecibo telescope, which we unfortunately no longer do. So we see that. Do we practice METI and try to contact them, in your view?
I don't think it matters, and I'll give you the reason why, even if we contact them or not. If they have a technology to send radio communications to Earth, is, I think that's what you are asking, which means that they know where Earth is located, which means they probably had or have similar kind of Earth level technology, because we also have radio communication here, right? Well, if they have similar kind of technology, they must have built telescopes to look at our planet already. So they know where we exist here. They know that Earth has biological life. They will also know that Earth has technological life. So whether we do METI or not becomes irrelevant at that point, because they already know. Probably that's one of the reasons why they sent the signal in the first place, because they found using their telescopes that there is a habitable planet with biology and technology. Oh, let's try to send a radio communication to them. This is what we would do, right? And that's what they would do too. So at that point, METI, whether we do or not, becomes, you know, irrelevant, in my opinion.
You know, that's an interesting thought, because say we found a biosphere in an exoplanet that just says there's some life there. Mm-hmm. Would we immediately respond by saying, asking ourselves the question globally, should we start beaming a regular radio signal towards it? If there isn't a civilization there, it doesn't matter, because we may not be able to know. But should we engage in things like that? When we find exoplanets, should we just start beaming a hello signal and maintaining it?
I think from my perspective, it wouldn't hurt. If we find only biology on that planet, and if we are sending radio signals, first of all, that's fine. From my perspective, it doesn't matter. And if there is a technological civilization, we find one, and if we are able to discover a technological civilization on an exoplanet, again, if we do METI, the sending signals or not is irrelevant, because if they have a technology, they must have already found us. It's like, I'll give an example. It's like a small kid trying to hide by closing their eyes, thinking that they are hiding. It's not going to happen, right? So it's just we are already discovered.
I think the ultimate irony would be as if we did METI and then we get a signal back essentially telling us to be quiet. They're trying to do radio astronomy. Chances. Okay, so the galaxy is big, 100,000 light years across. So when we do SETI, are we necessarily confined to the close? Meaning that if there's a civilization, a super civilization across the galaxy, halfway across it, it's just simply too far unless we have a radio telescope the size of Chicago to ever have any hope of detecting. So are we constrained in what we can look for as far as technosignatures? Do we necessarily have to look close, or is there a chance that we could see something far away?
So with radio communications, we can scan much larger part of the galaxy than with any kind of other kind of technosignature searches, just because radio communications can travel much further out into the galaxy. So from that point of view, yes, we can potentially look at larger distances with radio. But if we are using telescopes, normal, you know, optical telescopes, the ones that we use, we might be able to look only within our solar neighborhood, within like few tens of light years around the sun. For habitable and inhabited planets.
Now, moving closer to home, we saw a very strange object, Oumuamua, and it was tossed out there that perhaps this thing might have been a piece of alien technology. I personally believe that it was a weird rock. I'm not ready to go alien yet, but I appreciate that the idea was just unabashedly tossed out there. What is your thoughts on that object? Do you think that by searching interstellar objects and that the the fact that the very first one we saw was weird is it bodes well for searching for technosignatures within the solar system, alien flotsam flying through the solar system.
So I'm glad you asked this question, because just last week I was at a conference. I organized a conference called Exoplanets in Our Backyard. And then one of the speakers, Steve Desch from Arizona State University, presented his work on the interstellar object Oumuamua. And Steve presented a really nice summary of the current status on the Oumuamua. And it's from my perspective as a scientist, it's a pretty convincing result that is very likely a piece of a Pluto-like planet from another star system based on the evidence that they have. But that gives us the whole process of Oumuamua and its discovery and the corresponding, you know, controversy, or it shows us the scientific process of something that is anomalous. So this how a scientific process works when you're trying to solve an anomaly, collect more data, provide your hypothesis, rule out your hypothesis if the data is not supporting it, and then focus on the things that are the hypothesis is supporting. And this is where we are right now with Oumuamua. It's a classic scientific process in action for this particular event.
Oh, absolutely. I've been watching the paper since its discovery, and it's just been amazing to watch the scientific process work, because there just were so many different hypotheses put out there, hydrogen icebergs and all this sort of thing. Here's my question about the whole thing is that, okay, so we start doing all sky surveys with the LSST. We should see a population of Oumuamuas. We should see like objects. Do you think this becomes a wow signal if we don't?
That is an interesting idea. That is certainly the case. But then wow signal, we didn't have enough data for that. In Oumuamua case as well, we didn't have enough data. But then we have more than enough, a little bit more than enough data to kind of conclude that, at least to reach a consensus, I would say, that it is most likely a natural part of, a natural, it's a piece of a planet or an asteroid that came from another star system. With the wow signal, we just didn't have that kind of enough data to make even a prediction where it came from.
Like lack of data. Now, we're getting better at data collection, however, and with these all sky surveys and everything, we can begin to look for technosignatures in the solar system. Do you think that that's a viable place to look? Do you think it's that just as likely that there might be something out in the solar system, a von Neumann probe or something, versus a distant radio signal? Do you think that the radio signals are the better chance, or any other distant technosignature? Or do we stand a really good chance maybe of finding something in our own star system?
So within our, so there is actually within the technosignature subfield, the study of solar system technosignatures. We even wrote a white paper recently on looking for technosignatures within our solar system, led by my colleague Jacob Hagmishra. To see which one is likely, I would probably look for both. And I think we have more in terms of telescope and time and resource investment in the radio kind of technosignatures, because that has been more popular and has been going on for several decades. I am not entirely sure if we have the same kind of resources and time we have put in to look for probes within our solar system. And so to answer directly your question, if you ask me right now, which one has a more likely chance, I would probably say because of the kind of investment in resources, radio signatures compared to the solar system probe searches. But if we put more efforts in looking for solar system probes, we might be able to increase that likelihood.
Now, if you have a probe in the solar system of alien origin, say a scenario, for example, a passing star system in the past, they came close and they're like, well, that is an interesting exoplanet with life on it. We'll station a probe here, a self-repairing probe that can just sit here and monitor them indefinitely. And that solves the problem of distance, because the sun does pass by other star systems. So maybe more has been made of the distance problem than is actually there. In other words, people have always said there can't be an alien presence in the solar system because of the distances are just too great. Do you think that really is not quite the case?
There are proposals, at least for within the solar neighborhood, There are proposals for how we can, how a technological civilizations can potentially develop technology that could cross between the interstellar space. So there, if depending on the level of technology that we can think about, I think at least for the nearby stars, given enough time, there is certainly a possibility that we could cross the distances between them. And imagine, the reason why I'm saying this is because 100 years ago, if you ask someone, I think there was even an article somewhere I read, if you ask what is the most advanced technology at the time, and you would say, that would be some kind of horse carts with faster, or maybe multiple horses, or you could have some sort of wings to your buggies or something. So those kind of technologies that we can imagine right now. So the imagination of higher level traveling technology changes with every generation. So right now we think about how to cross the interstellar spaces based on the kind of technology we have. I'm sure if you ask the same question 100 years from now, and if you're having this interview, then I would say that, they might say, it's certainly possible.
So in other words, we have a paradigm in which we think, but in the past, every human that's ever lived had a paradigm. And up until now, they ended up generally being wrong. And there was more to the story than what they had thought.
Right. We are limited by the imagination of that time.
So let's say, if it's a possibility to look for technosignatures within the solar system, chances are if they're in the solar system, they're here, as in our atmosphere with us. But there's always been, at least to my eyes, a bias against the study of UAP or the UFO phenomenon, whatever you want to call it, a bias against science actually looking into that. And you had mentioned in a recent talk a paper by Dr. James McDonald from 1969. Now, I read this paper, and that paper, to me, could have been written yesterday, because it still seems to reflect the taboo on mentioning the word UFO. Do you think that it's time that we got rid of that taboo and we took a serious scientific look and inquiry into the UFO phenomenon?
I think, first of all, I'm a proponent of a scientific approach to this issue. And any unknown phenomena needs to be approached with a scientific process. So there is absolutely no question that we should do it a scientific methodology for this, to understand this phenomenon.
Now, where does it start? Where do we start in a scientific probe of UAP? If you were designing an instrument to look into these aerial phenomena, where would you start? I mean, what sort of data set do you want?
I would not do anything different than what I would be doing already, depending on my skill set. If I'm an engineer, I know, and if I have a colleague who is a scientist, what I would do is I will first collect a multidisciplinary team of scientists who would be able to look at this phenomena. So we need to look at all optical and all spectral bands in optical, infrared spectra, and so on. We need to have meteorologists, because these are happening within our atmosphere. We need to have engineers. We need to have aerospace experts, and we need to have scientists and physicists who would be able to understand and analyze the data. And we need data analysis people. We need to first collect data before we do the analysis.
Do you think that the accounts that people report of UAP give a starting point? Do they tell you, can you look for patterns, and can you determine if there's any particular points on Earth that is where you need to look?
I don't know enough about that to say anything, just because I don't know where these phenomena exactly are happening. But I would say that would be a good starting point. But that would not be an evidence of anything, but that would be a good starting point to start a scientific investigation.
Now, Dr. McDonald, who's been gone for many decades, suffered heavily for his interest in UAP and was basically publicly discredited and berated from several points, including a senator and a very prominent skeptic. And as a scientist reading Dr. McDonald's paper, what do you think of his work? Do you find that paper a compelling reason, as he was trying to present, for scientists to look into UAP? And there will be a link to this paper in the description below so everybody can read it.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I absolutely think that everybody who is interested in understanding the scientific phenomena, scientific process of understanding the UAP phenomena, should read Dr. McDonald's Science in Default. When I first read that, I thought I felt like I was reading a technical document, a scientific technical document, because this is how we write our papers. So when that paper provided a template for me, at least, to see, okay, if someone is doing a scientific investigation of UAP, these are the kind of things that one should follow. These are the things that one should do based on this Science in Default document.
What I found interesting about that particular paper was the cases he detailed weren't just multiple cases of visual sightings. There was radar. And that means that whatever this is, it interacts electromagnetically with the electromagnetic spectrum, which means that it should be measurable, right? So there's something here that we can sink our teeth into, and we have a good chance of actually collecting actionable data on it. Can you make the case to other scientists that we have that with this?
So when I talk with my colleagues about this phenomena, I mentioned that some of these things have been recorded on multiple instruments, and also by the pilots who have been doing these kind of measurements for a while now, because that's what kind of instruments they use for their flying experience, right, or for their training. I think this is the right way to when I also tell my colleagues that when you are in doubt, when you have a question about something, go directly to the source, so that you will get the most accurate information to at least make a wise judgment that, okay, there is something over there. And so that is how I started with. I went directly to the sources, the pilots, a good friend of mine, Ryan Graves, and we talked about it. And then, you know, then I started reading Dr. McDonald's papers. And that's when I thought there is definitely a scientific investigation needed here to understand this phenomena.
Now, do we run a danger of putting our own human biases on the phenomenon? In other words, is it possible that since we're seeing something, that it might actually be outside of our paradigm? And what I'm getting at here is the work of another astronomer, J. Allen Hynek, and also information scientist Dr. Jacques Vallée, that maybe what we're seeing is weirder than aliens, and that maybe we should be open to the possibility that there's areas of science that we know we don't understand, and that maybe this phenomenon might be related to that as opposed to proper aliens. Do you think that we need to be open to that? Or can we say, no, there's something here, but it's more likely to be aliens, which is ultimately what McDonald concluded, was that the alien hypothesis was the least worst one. Could we end up in that boat and actually have data on UAP and still not know what they are?
It is quite possible, but I would first focus on collecting the data before we go into any sort of speculative hypothesis, because this is how I'm trained as a scientist, right? So before I could make any kind of opinion, I want to know, am I being fooled by the data? Am I collecting the whole data? Am I getting the whole picture of the phenomena? And so once I have the data in my hand, in the scientist's hand, then I would be able to make some sort of a guidance or judgment regarding which way or which hypothesis is being favored more after I've done the analysis.
Now, what is your opinion on Ryan Graves' citing his report? Now, I personally believe him, and I also believe David Fravor and the pilots from the Nimitz and all that. When the pilots are telling me something, I tend to take note because they're trained observers, and but a lot of times, at least the Navy says, they have multiple instrument data on it. They just can't show it to us for national security purposes. So this, to me, points that we have an eminently good chance of trying to identify the UAP phenomenon. Are you convinced, and I'll ask this point blank, are you convinced that UAP exists?
I think that's no longer a question.
I have to agree there. I can't ignore it anymore. I can't ignore the option.
We have moved that beyond that point.
Yeah, we are. And well, we have government saying that there's something to it. The question is what worries me is if we can't pin it on aliens.
So I wouldn't bring up aliens now with the UAPs only because we don't know what they are.
They are unidentified by their very nature. Yep.
Exactly. Yep.
But say they are. Is that a little bit of a different situation than detecting a distant radio signal that you finally find out there is an alien civilization more advanced than you are sitting in your atmosphere with you? Does that keep you up at night? Because it does me.
I think if we find, so I'm going to talk this from the technosignature standpoint. If we find because we always look for, this is an active research problem in the technosignature field, to look for probes within our solar system, look for probes from other civilizations. We are already looking for it. So for me, it will not be an entirely surprising thing, but here is where I would differ. Not a surprising thing, but would be a completely what would call. That's when I would probably jump up and be happy.
I would be like the guy from the Twilight Zone episode, To Serve Man, running around yelling it's a cookbook. I admit it. but just the possibility, though, is very intriguing. Now, how did you come into contact with Mr. Graves?
So this was last year, I think I was invited to give a talk on UAP phenomena at American Institute, AIAA, and they were having an aviation forum in August, I believe. And I was asked to give a talk over there, and then Ryan was one of, they also asked Ryan at that point, and then that's how we met first time.
Now, free fall, and that's something that that you presented at, I believe, the AIAA. The behavior of some of the observed objects and freefall. Give us an overview of that point that you made.
So I just derived some equations and tried to estimate the amount of freefall time that an object would take within the Earth's gravitational field, and tried to compare that with the reported observations of some of these UAP objects that they have observed, pilots have observed, at least the reported ones, and try to compare. And my point was to say that, okay, if we use the known, whatever we know about the free fall of an object in within the Earth's atmosphere, using the drag equations, using the Earth's gravitational field, how much time would it take for the object to fall from certain height to the sea level or something? And then try to compare that time scale with the amount of time that these reported objects were performing. And that didn't seem to be consistent. And that's what I reported, in that it's publicly available. So you can see that talk.
Now, the breaking the laws of physics is something that a lot of UAP sightings seem to be doing. But I wonder about something here. Phenomena of light spoofing. Something that's not there. Light can appear to break the laws of physics. It's, you know, just like a light beam, you know, passing by, it can do it. It can actually break the speed of light, but that's because it isn't physically really there. It's just sort of a moving boundary. So my question is, might we be seeing spoofing of some sort based on light? And this is all some experiment by another nation state.
It is completely possible. And it is completely possible for some phenomena, but to explain, to use that reasoning for every UAP phenomena, that would be a stretch of imagination, I would say.
Do you anticipate that as we gather data on UAP, and there are a number of projects doing this, including NASA and the Galileo Project and the federal government, you know, the Pentagon. With all of these collections of data, is it very likely you think that we're going to find a mixed bag of explanations or lack of explanations thereof?
I think at this point, at least, I'll be happy that at least we have a bag, because there wasn't even a bag before, right? And so now we have at least data. When you say a mixed bag, it's a mixed bag of collection of data points. And that's good. Even if we can't figure it out immediately, we have some good algorithms, like machine learning algorithms, you know, AI, for example. We can use them to understand this data better. So at least I'm happy that there's going to be a bag of things.
That's something that we didn't have before, is all of the, you know, the AI and machine learning and everything else that we have that we can look at data sets with. In other words, we don't have to look at thousands of pictures of bugs and birds to spot the UAP. And we can actually reduce this down to a workable data set. Do you think that's actually been a factor in the reluctance of science to look into the UAP phenomena? Because how you have to collect data, physical data beyond personal accounts, at one time may have just been too hard. So it's just too hard to look at the sky for a long enough period to see anything.
That's right. So witness accounts can be good for law and order, but not for science, right? So we need actual hard collecting data. And so right now we have more tools, we have more techniques, analysis techniques. We use these machine learning algorithms in our own science everyday work as well. And so I'm quite engaged that we now have the capability to do this kind of analysis and have the data collection methods.
Do you think before this point, it would have been basically impossible, though, to study UAP in a way that we could actually write scientific papers and publish them in respectable journals? Do you think that we just, up until this point, did not have that capability?
I wouldn't say it would be impossible. I would just say that we are now paying more attention to it. Then more minds, more ideas, more analysis. That's why we are here right now.
Now, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, I believe, the AIAA, is something you are involved in and looking into a probe in itself. What does that look like?
So I can talk about only the community of interest, and I would also recommend you to talk with Ryan at some point, because he's the chair of this committee. Perhaps you already did. My involvement with the AIA UAP study is I'm a co-chair. I'm the co-chair for this community. It's called Community of Interest, where we have, after my presentation last year at the Aviation Forum, a couple of us together with the help of Ed Stanton from AIA and Nijo Bram from AIA. We formed together a group of people, a community, to start providing how to bring together several people from different aviation disciplines to look at this UAP phenomena. The focus is more on the safety, aviation safety. And since last 1 year, we have grown to several tens of members here. An accurate number you can obtain from Ryan, actually. That's where we stand.
Have you looked into the other case that's floating around, the Nimitz case with David Fravor and all that? And do you think does that give us some sort of a starting point? In other words, do we need to go near U.S. carrier groups or something like that to look for UAP?
So we can do things even beyond that right now, even here, with some sort of from different disciplined scientists. So like the Galileo Project is doing right now, right? They've collected a group of scientists. So that is one possible way we could look for these UAP phenomena and collect the data, not just necessarily from the naval side.
This is something else that I find odd. So if you have an alien civilization in your atmosphere with you, that must mean necessarily, right, that there are alien civilizations everywhere. Yet we look out and we see the Fermi paradox. We see the great silence. We see nothing. So is it at odds that you would be seeing something here but not out there?
So you're asking if we see something here, and, well, that assumes that we know how to recognize an alien technology everywhere, right?
Right.
So remember what I was mentioning, that anomalous signatures is what we want to look for. There are things that we can look for that we know. From at least for the exoplanet perspective, we know what technosignatures we can look for, but that doesn't mean that we can recognize many of these technosignatures. The same reasoning can be applied for looking for alien signals, or at least the technosignatures within our solar system. We need to look for anomalies. If something doesn't fit the data we collected and doesn't fit the worldview that we have, we should pay more attention and collect more data before we reach any foundational conclusions.
Now, when looking into the universe with SETI, do you think that we have biases? In other words, we tend to look at star systems, sun-like star systems, but maybe that's not where aliens stay. Maybe they go and exist near, you know, high-energy environments like a black hole or something like that. Should we step back and take a broader view of SETI and maybe look in places where we might not have thought to look before, or we had said, no, that's not likely? But should we take a look at those places? You know, should we be very thorough in our search?
I think this is a really great question, because many of the great discoveries have happened not because people were looking for them, because people were doing something else and they found something else, something, you know, more profound. One of the most famous examples is exoplanets themselves. The first exoplanet that was discovered, at least the confirmed one, a very robust detection was around pulsar planets around dead stars. They were not even looking for planets. They were doing pulsar observations, and they just happened to find these planets around them. And so when you ask, okay, do we want to expand looking for technosignatures or to find kind of life on other worlds? We are already doing that. We are looking almost everywhere. Of course, blind spots. For example, if someone says, there are hot Jupiters, you know, very hot planets very close to the stars, or, you know, it's hot planets. And we think, how come life could exist on those kind of unusual environments? Or if we see a dead planet like Mars, for example, how can there be a technosignature over there? Well, there is a technosignature on Mars right now. And there is an alien spacecraft on there too. That's ours, right? We sent rovers over there. So within our solar system, there are a lot of technosignatures. And so if someone is looking at our solar system, they would be able to find these technosignatures if they have the capability and have the detection sensitivity. So while we are looking at usual places for discovering alien civilizations, we should also keep an open eye on unusual locations where we don't usually think there could be signs of life on them. That's why I keep talking about anomalies. Please keep an eye on anomalies, because that's where I think we would find more interesting discoveries.
Anomalous atmospheres. So say you have a Mars-like planet that you're able to observe in another star system. And that Mars-like planet, you have a reasonably good idea how old it is. Say it's 4.5 billion years old. And yet it has an atmosphere it shouldn't. It's got a thick atmosphere that it shouldn't have been able to hold on to. Have we really started to ponder over those kinds of technosignatures where you actually see anomalous planets in and of themselves showing no biosignatures or technosignatures per se, but just very weird circumstances that they shouldn't be in?
This is a great question, because this is a line of work that several of my colleagues are actually undertaking right now. Because this is related to terraforming kind of technosignatures, right? So if you see two planets in a system that have very similar atmospheres, that is a kind of a suspicious thing, because having two planets having very, very similar evolution would raise red flags. It could possibly be natural evolution could have done that, but it is also possible that there's some sort of a terraforming. This is called the terraforming of planets, right? It's not natural. It's something else has happened to it. If you have a planet with a dense atmosphere where it shouldn't be having, or, you know, having an atmosphere it shouldn't be having, that is certainly a suspect planet for a technosignature. That's one possibility, though. So we have to keep that in mind.
I think what would be really interesting is if we saw such a thing, an impossible planet like that, we didn't just see one, we saw a cluster. all nearby each other in nearby star systems. And that would bolster the case, right, that you're looking at a spacefaring civilization that's altering planets.
Actually, that's quite plausible, by the way. And so we have several publications on that. At least we were thinking about it to see what kind of planets can civilizations could produce these kind of similar kind of technosignatures on adjacent planets.
I think that would probably be the most amazing thing, because that not only tells you that they exist, but that they're very advanced and that it is possible for us to terraform worlds. Although I guess we already know that we're doing a fairly decent job terraforming this one.
Yes.
All right, Doctor, that's it for today. And thanks for dropping by. And I hope we can have a conversation again in the future as data collection on UAP happens.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Event Horizon and my channel are now available as a podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube memberships. Early ad-free episodes, bonus episodes, and sleep-focused content. Sign up now by clicking the links below to your platform of choice. Anna, why is the possum building a huge metal tower in the backyard?
He's going into a new technology, John.
Yeah, and what technology is that?
Shortwave radio.
Wait a minute, that's a new technology, shortwave radio?
No. But what you don't know is that's how alien civilizations communicate.
Yeah. Wait a minute, he's handing me a script. He wants me to read something to the aliens.
I suggest doing so, John. The stakes may be higher than you think regarding the aliens.
From the high desert and the great American Southwest, I bid you good evening. Wait a second, this isn't my outro or my intro.
He finds it ironic and funny.
Yeah, all right. Well, let's do it proper. Thanks for listening. I am science fiction author and futurist John Michael Godier, currently getting mocked by an opossum. And be sure to check out my books at your favorite online book retailer and subscribe to my channels for regular in-depth explorations into the interesting, weird, and unknown aspects of this amazing universe in which we live.
Did you do that from memory, John?
Indeed I did.
Who was she?
I can't say.